The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So this evening I wanted to talk about fear. And the reason it's talking about fear is somewhat personal, in that I spent a good part of the last 23 days, close to 23 days, being afraid. And so that's interesting. And it was interesting, and it was my companion for my journey. And it was a good companion to have. And I was content to be afraid, to have fear. And it felt like actually a very important support for the journey that I was on. So it's a particular perspective on fear. There's many forms of fear, many ways of being afraid. But I'll offer you one perspective maybe that is not offered so often. But many times when people think of fear, they think of it as something undesirable. Some people's attitude towards fear is that it's something is wrong when there's fear and we shouldn't be afraid. And if you're a seasoned mindfulness practitioner like me, you know, you should have long since gotten over fear and not have any fear. But I found that during this journey that I was on, that fear was a valuable companion and interesting companion, something that I had to contend with and work with and look at and understand. So the fear that I had was came from spending 23 days rafting down the Grand Canyon. And for those of you who don't know the Grand Canyon, it's once you head out into the Grand Canyon from the top place called Lee's Landing, there's only one or two spots you can turn around. I can't turn around, but you can. There's only one or two spots where you can kind of come out. And it involves a very long hike, and so basically we were stuck. And it's a beautiful place, the Grand Canyon. It's I think it's one of the national treasures of the United States, for many reasons. But one reason is because of the geology of the place. It's spectacularly beautiful for some people who like that kind of beauty. It's also gives you a wonderful cross-section of the geology, not only of the North American continent, but of this land before it was a North American continent. Some of the oldest parts of the Grand Canyon were formed south of the equator. Long ago, long before there was a North American continent, and slowly over time, you know, the continents move, and that piece of land moved up and came North America. So it's a very ancient land, and you can go through it, and the way the river cuts through the canyon, it goes almost a mile deep, and you see the you know, you can see these geological layers, and you can go back in time and kind of. And but there's a river cutting through it. There's a river that's cut the canyon, and some people will go rafting down the canyon. We went on rubber rafts with oars rowing down. And 14 people and five rafts. And periodically, you come to rapids. And those rapids are, there was a primary reason why I had fear. There were other reasons, but that was a primary one. And I'd never been down the Grand Canyon, I'd never done anything like this. So I had primarily had my imagination of what these rapids would be. But I'd heard some of the names. And some of the names for people who kind of been a little bit paid attention to the rapids of the Grand Canyon loom kind of big in the consciousness. And so there was like lava. Lava, so like maybe the biggest one of the big, maybe the biggest one there. And it comes near the end of the trip, so you have the whole trip to think about. We're going to have to face lava. So there was a badger, and Hans, and house, and crystal, specter, bedrock, lava, and then one that became very dear for me called Killer Fang. So I'm a novice. I'd never rafted before, never been down these kinds of rapids before. I didn't know what to expect. So so the imagination goes a little wild. In my imagination, I was looking up at 20-foot waves. I didn't know what to expect. But we got a little bit of sense of it on the very first day, in the first set of a little bit bigger rapids, where I was rowing. I wasn't rowing. I was just a passenger. I didn't know how to row in the rapids. My wife and I were in the front of the boat, and we've been told that if the boat starts tipping to one side, you do something called high siding, and you go and climb up on the high side of the boat. You don't get away from the tipping. You go towards it to tip the boat back. So, okay, so we went down for this rapid, and we started high siding, so we threw ourselves up. And it felt to me like we were going up a wave and down the other side, and then next wave, and we were going up tipping. And so we kept throwing ourselves up. And so we were doing this for a little bit, maybe three times, four times. And then I happened to look down to my left in the water next to the boat, and the head of the person who was rowing the boat popped up out of the water. So, oh, he's supposed to be behind me. Rowing, who's in control of this boat? And he had popped out of the boat because he's pretty strong forces on this boat. And I found out when I talked to him later that he had ended up under the boat. And we had just been prepared a short while before about what to do if you're under the boat. So he found his way out of under the boat. And his head popped up, and I said, "Oh!" So I pulled him up on the boat, and then it turned out that another rower had popped out of her boat, and so that we had kayaks with us, and so someone, a kayaker, came and got her, and so that was kind of a nice beginning. But also, what was coming? So there definitely was danger involved with these. We were with very skilled guides who knew how to do the rapids, knew how to do the sol. We're in very good hands, but it's kind of unpredictable what's going to happen. And so there, as I got days went along, I got a better sense of what to expect, and the imagination of 20-foot waves kind of receded. But these rapids came along, and some of them are big enough and dangerous enough, we would get out of the boats and we'd scout them. We would go stand on a little bluff and look down at them. And we would study carefully for a long time the waves, the currents, the rocks in the river, how the current was flowing, where the rocks were, and trying to figure out what's called a line, figure out what is the safest way to go through here. So all this is to tell you that one of the reasons why I had fear, and other people on the trip had fear as well. So one evening we had a discussion about fear and people's fears, probably help people, contend with all this. And I took my fear as my companion, which meant that I kind of saw it as something that was kind of coming along with me on my side. It was there, it was next to me, kind of, as opposed to the fear was me. I didn't identify the fear as I'm afraid, but rather as a fear was this thing that came along, and it wasn't going to be an obstacle. I wasn't going to let it, it was there. It was there to inform me. It was there to take care of me. It was there to tell me, be cautious, pay attention. One of the best rowers on the river, was a wonderful man who was very good at rowing, understanding the river, and But it, my wife often went with him, and she said that occasionally he would be, you know, coming to a rapids or something, and he was easily distracted, and you know, looking at birds or something, and she said that she explained, well, he would go, suddenly he would go, oh shit. And then he would row safely, row away from whatever the shit was. And so my wife, who was, you know, at the beginning of the trip, ended up more scared, really scared of this, all this. She developed a lot of confidence in this person and really preferred to be in his boat, even though that there was this oh shit thing. So it was kind of exciting. But the idea of fear, you know, is there to inform us. It's a useful emotion. It's a useful thing to have in certain circumstances. And the idea is to keep us more cautious, pay attention, and help us to maybe gauge what we can do and can't do, what's appropriate and not appropriate. And so some of these rapids we came to, we had the choice of whether to walk around and avoid, and let the boats go through and walk around. Some of the people who were rowing decided that for some of these big rapids they were not up for it. And so other people who knew, who were rowers, who could row, there was a kayaker who came with us, who was a very good rower. And so sometimes some of the regular rowers said, not this one. And then the kayaker would put his boat on the kayak in the back of one of the rafts, and he would take the boat through. So the idea that fear has a role in our lives and helps us stay safe, helps us to be cautious, helps us to discern. And then how do we pay attention to fear, that kind of fear in this kind of circumstances, to take the lessons from it and know what's appropriate and not appropriate, when to do something and when not to do it. What I found for myself was it wasn't necessarily a rational, consciously thought out decision. It didn't really come out so much with the rapids, but there was another thing that we did that involved fear, and that it was a big part of the trip was hiking up the side canyons of the Grand Canyon. And you'd think just a nice little hike up a canyon's nice, but four of the people in our party were mountain climbers, and they had this different idea of what hiking up a canyon meant. And some of the canyons, you know, you go in a little bit, and then there's these, you know, these cliffs to climb up or ledges to climb up to the next level. And there was some, from my, you know, non-mountain climbing experience, some very creative mountain climbing techniques used to get up to where we were going. And there was something called the bridge in mountain climbing. I don't know if you don't know what the bridge is, but that is that, we had these narrow, some of the canyons got really narrow and a little bit deep, you know. I mean, not that deep, but, you know, we would have fallen maybe 8 feet in some places. But they were kind of narrow, but they were kind of like maybe 5 feet wide. But the way you go up is you put your hands on one side and your feet on the other side, and you're vertical. You know, and you're kind of finding your way, and you kind of one hand at a time. And so that was a new technique for me. And so there also, you know, do I go up here? Do I go up on this ledge? Do I go up on these narrow ledges high up the canyon where you have to kind of maybe just a foot or something, and you have to go around an edge, and you have to bend around and, you know, hold on to just something with your bare, you know, little fingernails. And, you know, do I do this? What do I feel comfortable with here, and what fear do I listen to, and when do I let fear be my companion to help me be cautious but not to fear, and when do I listen to it and say, oh, this is not for me? So there were some times with the canyon walks that I said, oh, that's not for me, and sometimes when other people said it's not for me, but I went ahead and I felt comfortable. So for me, it was a fascinating time to be with fear, and I got to look at it and got to look at some of the issues that come up around fear. I wondered sometimes whether the people on the trip would be disappointed in me. I'm a Buddhist teacher, or been around for a long time, you know, and he shouldn't be afraid. And so the social unacceptability of being afraid. But you know, I thought that, well, that's their problem. I don't have to be worried about what they think about me. But the idea of, you know, the social acceptability of it, or what we, you know, what it looks like in other people's eyes, and people's approval or rejection, it looms big for some people and with their emotional life. There was also, it was uncomfortable to be afraid. And so some people will feel any kind of discomfort is wrong. It's a sign of failure, or something needs to be fixed. Or if we're really on top of our game and top of our life, we wouldn't feel this way. And so there's something wrong with me because I'm afraid. And it's embarrassing to let people know that something's wrong with me this way. And so I could see these kinds of thoughts, you know, pass through, but I had enough wisdom to know not to believe them and be caught in them. But I could see them come through, and these kinds of thoughts. But what I felt very comfortable with was the idea that fear is was my companion, as next to me, and it was there for me to take its lessons. It was there for me to listen to and to tune into and pay attention to. But it wasn't there to interfere. It wasn't there to be an obstruction for what I did. So I never felt that that the fear was a cause, was an obstruction, or was a hindrance for me. But it was a guide. And so, and sometimes when I did listen to my fear and didn't do something, then I really clearly felt that I was making the decision. I was doing this, and the fear was part of that decision. But I never felt that fear had control over me. I never felt that I became fear. I didn't identify with the fear as being who I am, or I didn't identify or define myself by the fear. It was just a companion. It came along. It was there as part of the geology, ancient fear. I've read that, I guess people who study these kinds of stuff say that the different fears that human beings have are pretty instinctual, but they come from different evolutionary eras of human life. So apparently all mammals have fear of heights. Not about all, but, you know, at least normal ones. It's pretty common for mammals to have fear of heights. I don't know if bats have fear of heights, but... So fear of heights. And is it called simians? People of this, you know, the... You know, like people. animals in the monkey... Families? It's a family division? I don't know what it is. Like us, humans. Fear of snakes. Humans have a particular instinct that seems to be unique to humans that evolved with human social life and maybe agricultural life and things, and that is fear of mice. And that other simians don't seem to have. So we have these layers, you know, going inside. And perhaps, you know, deeper and deeper, if you go back, like in Grand Canyon, you go back, you know, it's 1.8 billion years you go back and see. If you look inside your own mind, deep, you know, there's a way in which you can go deeper and deeper in your mind, and you're kind of going through kind of the evolutionary layers. And some of these fears, you know, have these layers and layers and layers. And so which fears operate for us? What are the fears that operate for you? You know, is the fear of missing out on the next email? You know, I don't think that's, you know, evolutionarily so deep down in there. I think that's a little bit, you know, kind of new for most of us, I guess, for all of us, I suppose, it's in our own lifetime. You know, we miss out the email or miss that TV program or afraid of technology and things like that. So I offer you all this because I think to live a wise life we all need to come to terms with our fear. We all need to spend time with it, look at it, look at the nature of our fear, how we're afraid, what we're afraid of, what the role of the imagination is in our fear, so for me, I was very clear at the beginning of the trip that a lot of my fears were imaginary because I'd never gone down the river, I'd never dealt with these rapids. And then as we went along the rapids, I think that my imagination receded, my projections and, you know, imaginary fears, and I had a more realistic, much more realistic sense of what was appropriate to be afraid of and how to be afraid. And I learned over the course of the trip a lot about how to read the river. And I never knew that, you never had considered that you would read a river. But there's all these things you can read and understand about a river. And it was fascinating to learn that language or learn that, to read that book. So then I began understanding what's going on and where the real dangers are and what was imaginary. And so the fear took a different nature. I could see that it shifted from this imaginary ideas that I had, which I kind of knew were imaginary, so that helped me not to be too caught in them, to being very much more concrete and specific, and oh, there's a fear. So when I saw Killer Fang, I knew that this is not good news. But by the time I saw Killer Fang, which is the name of a rock, there was no reason for fear, or no room for fear. There was not that fear; just was not relevant. It just because it was so imminent, it was like we better do something now. Like we better focus on the situation at hand. There's no room for fear or any concern for fear. It's just like, this is what, you know, this is, we've got to get to work here. So it worked out relatively well for everyone in the boat, except for me. Because we missed the out, so the current pushed us right up against this rock. But it was right where I was sitting, and so we were going to hit it, and the fear was we were going to tip over the boat. So I high sided to receive the rock, and the next thing that I knew was I was in the water. The person behind the boat who watched, that they got different impact of the rock. I was right there. Remember these rubber boats, you know, are kind of like a big bounce. She said, "Gil, it was wonderful to watch because you just very relaxedly rolled over backwards." And for me, all I knew was that suddenly I was in the water and foam all around me. So it was kind of nice. It was refreshing. And then I had to get to safety, and I came up right next to the boat. But where I came with the boat was there was nothing to hold on to, and so I. And then the current took me away from the boat, but the other boat, the oh shit boat, was always ready. It seemed like always there, ready whenever we needed help. In fact, he was just waiting 20 feet away and 30 feet away. So I swam to that boat and got pulled up. It was fine. So it was fascinating to kind of be in all this and to explore the fear and the lack of fear and the engagement with the action when it was needed. So it's, you know, it's maybe it makes, I don't know if you're interested in hearing these tales, but, you know, it's a particular situation for fear, and I don't want to generalize from that and all the other kinds of fears that people have. There's many causes of fear, many physiological and psychological reactions around fear that are quite deep and quite strong and very difficult for people, that come from terrible things that happen and life experiences. And I don't want to, you know, this to be a statement about what other people should do with theirs. But in talking about it, I was hoping to talk about fear in a way that maybe is not so commonly talked about, to talk about fear as a companion and not to consider in a perspective where fear is not considered to be wrong or a problem, but something that can be a support and aid. And so if you have fear in your life, maybe you're willing to take a second look at it now. Take your time with it. And what is the role of imagination? How much of it is imaginary? How much are you looking at 20-foot high waves or some equivalent in your life? How much of it is real? How much of it is legacy of what happened a long time ago? It was a relatively small thing for me to, you know, I fell in the river. But what was interesting for me was that when I surfaced, I couldn't get a full breath of air. And I felt like, oh, I'm only getting half a breath of air. And you know, that's kind of a primal thing, not to be able to breathe. So I kind of thought, what happened? I didn't think about it much. I was trying to get just, you know, safety. But what went through my mind was that probably I swallowed some water. And then I swam to the boat. And as I swam, I was still kind of, not wheezing exactly, but kind of like, I don't know if you ever had it, maybe like an asthma or can't quite fully breathe or something. So every stroke, I was, ha! And then for the next kind of maybe 36 hours, there was this feeling, legacy in my chest of maybe a little bit of fear, of tightness, contraction, something there from that experience. And so I thought that was, you know, so what's that about? And it took me a while to finally figure out what, it actually took me a few days. And when I finally figured out what it was, then I could kind of, something inside of me let go. And that was, I never had this happen to me. The air was knocked out of me, my lungs. And one of the physiological, I didn't know about this, but one of the physiological reactions to having the air knocked out is the diaphragm can freeze briefly. And it's a little bit difficult for the lungs to kind of, the lungs have been emptied of their air, and somehow the bronchial tube, somehow it doesn't quite take it in as easily as it did before, as it used to. And so then when I understood that, oh, that's what happened. Then the legacy or the way it was held in my body kind of dissipated. But I needed to have that understanding of it. And, you know, that was a relatively, you know, having an air knocked out, people have that happen on the playground. So it's not a huge, doesn't have to be a huge thing. But the lesson of, you know, that sometimes it takes time to stay with the legacy of the fear, what's left over, and be with it in a wise way, learn to feel it, learn to work through it, learn to understand what it's about, perhaps, or it needs its own kind of process of attention and care. And then to learn, if you are afraid, how to have the fear not obstruct, not to hinder you. If there are things you want to do, to have the ability to do it in spite of being afraid, but not in spite of it foolishly, but with wisdom, where maybe you've paid attention to the fear well enough that you know that it's, you know, that's, it's appropriate to listen to it, it's not appropriate to listen to it, it's, you know, that, you know, to figure out what the appropriate role is for it in your life. I've certainly had social fears in my life, which, you know, were mostly not something that I needed to pay attention to. And so I let it kind of be there, I acknowledged it, and I continued to do what I wanted to do, what was appropriate to do. So I hope that these little words will give you some pause to reflect on your own relationship to fear, your own experience of fear, and what it might mean for you, if you do have fear, some kind of fear from time to time, or all the time, where would it mean for you to shift the perspective of it so your fear becomes something next to you, kind of, your companion? The fear is not you. You don't identify, I'm afraid, but rather there's fear here. And what information is there in that fear? What wisdom, what care, what attention is that is warranted from this fear? And what attention is not warranted? What is imaginary or what is not useful? So those are my thoughts, and from having lived for 23 days with fear as my friend. So we have about 10 minutes, and if any of you would like to ask any questions or have any comments or testimonials about fear as your friend, that would be great. Yes. Oh, let's have the mic right here. On the Jim is hoping someone from the stage is going to bring this mic down right here on the floor. I have to turn it on.
I had a testimonial about fear, so just echoing basically your experience, that I went through a period of my life where just very stressful and, you know, just not happy times, and it just kind of got to the point where I just go out in public and think it would feel like normal situations would feel dangerous in some way, so there's just like a lot of fear and like illogical fear, and you know, exposure therapy, you know, is fairly well researched and effective thing, and also I think in Buddhist practice there are these like extreme practices, like, you know, you go meditate in the graveyard and things like that. You intentionally expose yourself to fear, and so I was like, you know, I want to try this, but I want to try it in a way that's like going to be fun and not just like, you know, kind of like, you know, whitewater rafting, Grand Canyon. So I did 100 skydives.
What?
I did skydives.
Skydiving. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. Skydiving. Oh.
And so yeah. You have a lot of time to think, like a half-hour plane ride up. And like, I'm a total idiot. Why am I doing this? But it's also very safe, so it's like this balance where it's like it feels a lot more dangerous than it actually is, and so it really is mostly a mental thing. And I found that very healthy, just kind of like stretching the fear meter, you know, to the point where normal stuff isn't that big a deal. And just, you know, just practicing, be like, oh, just because I'm afraid doesn't mean I can't do it. And once I do it, it's going to get easier, and it's a process, and then just a little bit of mental discipline too, of just being like, well, I'm listening to the information, and like my gut's telling me, like the kind of, you know, elephant of my emotions wants to pull one way, and the rider of my reason is saying like, no, like we're going to go the way that we plan to go, like, you know, just there's a lot of value in just being able to do what you mm-hmm. want to do and not be.
And then it made a difference for you in your life to do that?
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic. Yeah, so you worked with your fear in a wonderful way. And, you know, instinctively, it doesn't seem like it's a safe thing to jump out of an airplane. But statistically, probably it's a lot safer than many things that people do and don't think about. If you do it the right way. Yeah, when I came back, and then driving back from the airport on the freeway, I wondered about, where am I safest?
So I have a question about kind of fear, and maybe it's a little bit more general than that too. So it sounds like when you were going through the Grand Canyon, like there's this fear that arose, but then there was also kind of this thought process on top of the fear of like, I think this is safe, or I don't feel like this is safe for me. And I guess my question is like, what is the role of that process on top of the just like being with fear, both in like daily life and also in meditation practice?
So I apologize, I didn't quite get to the beginning. So what's the role of
What's the role of that, like, overarching thought process?
Oh, the thought process.
Yeah, the thought process on top of the just, like, being with and understanding.
Yeah, I think thinking is a useful thing to do. And and so I think, you know, for me, some of the things that, like, mostly, the biggest decisions I had to make had to do with this kind of hiking the canyons and deciding whether to continue or not continue. And so all my faculties were operating. So it was, my thinking was operating, looking at the cliff, looking at the layout, looking at myself, my skill, my size. Some of the places I felt like I was too tall, where other people were short, could seem to easily do it. But for my height, I can't do this. And then the opposite was true for other people. And so all my faculties. So, but I think for me, I don't think I prioritized one faculty the other, but I also didn't reject one faculty over the other. So there was a wonderful way in which it felt kind of holistic to problem solving, like thinking, you know, looking and trying to understand, and the mechanics of it all, and considering myself and who I was with, and then the emotions related to it, and. You know, and also you have to be very, very much in your body. And so there was a lot of body intelligence and body sensitivity going on to understand and feel what was going on as well. It was not just cognitive, the whole thing. So I don't know if that answers the question, but all the faculties, that was part of what was so great, was to feel kind of alive with all the faculties operating all simultaneously. Up here.
Is that working?
Well, my first thing, I'm very grateful. I go whitewater canoeing a few times each year, and the waves are never as big as those that you were describing. But some of the other experiences are similar. So I liked your idea of the fear as your friend, but I was trying to say, well, would that work? And my experience is these rivers are usually scenic rivers, and they're very beautiful. And a good part of the time, the beauty is why you're there and what you're enjoying. Then you hear the sound.
The sound.
You get near the rapid.
That sound.
And then you feel that in your stomach. And so, and then you know that there are risks, that real risks. People do occasionally die in these kinds of places. So I'm just, what I have found, and I just kind of want to check this with you, is parallels yours. I don't think I've ever done the fear as a companion. And I like that idea of thinking that it's next to me and here we go, instead of, you know, no, don't go. And I also have done something that you mentioned there, is to think about it. Is this, what is the risk? And it's not much. You're following a line, you know, I know I've done it enough, I can find the line pretty much by myself, and when we go, there's somebody who's even better at it than I am that I get to follow. So, and then at some point you just make this decision. I'm going for it. The risk is small enough that chances are good. I'm going to make it.
Yeah. Space opens up in the fast lane of the freeway, and you decide to kind of slide right in. it's not that different for someone who's been skilled at the river. It's not that different than just what we do, people in the freeway all the time. We saw so many things we're reading on the freeway, but it's kind of second nature. But it's all new there, and it's. A little different, and so fear. I think one way of thinking about all this that I have sometimes is that this idea of being holistic, our whole inner processing works as a unit, works all together. So fear is just part of that whole inner. All the information, all the processing, all the figuring, all the way that things come together and are being informing each other, or it's all part of the kind of the the sentient kind of apparatus operating. And that fear is just is one element of it that is connected to many different factors around us and within us, some neurotic and some healthy. But fear is connected to so many different pieces. And I wouldn't want to single that out, but but if we can kind of hold all these things together as a whole, then I have a lot more confidence in the understanding and the decisions and the wisdom that can come from it. But when we signal one faculty out over the other and give it prominence as if that has the authority, the fear has authority and that's held out as being the thing, or if our rational mind has authority, it's just because I think it out, that's where think about it. If just thinking is going to solve all my problems, I'll think about it enough. For me, I find the most valuable is to somehow let it all operate and not single anything out, and then see what pops out, or see where the strength of the processing takes me in terms of where the decision is or what's going to come. And it's not necessarily obviously rational, but it's certainly not irrational either. I think one of the values that I've gotten from doing this practice of mindfulness is to be able to sit quietly and make room for all the faculties operating, not to shut anything out, though some of the faculties get quiet as I sit, but it's a quietness that is very allowing for the whole to operate. And so to have sit down and meditate and over again experience this whole, the wholeness of the faculties or the freedom of the faculties to operate. Because I think all our faculties, in my mind, are in mutual conversation with each other. And so to not have barriers to that kind of inner conversation, not to have blockages or not to have selective focus, is a very important part of this settling down and becoming open and connected and mindful. And that allows a whole, wide array of wisdom to operate, which is some people might call intuitive, some people might call it, I don't know what people would call it, but it's not, I wouldn't point to one particular faculty that it is. It's all the faculties operating together, and somehow out of that mix, understanding surfaces from time to time. And I have a lot of confidence in that process and that kind of wisdom that comes out. So that's one of the reasons why with fear, I think it's useful, at least for me, to think of fear as a companion that's next to me. Because then it can be in conversation with everything else in a better way, or I can be in conversation with it. But if I allow myself to be fear, to like just really kind of submerge myself in it or fall into it, or then it doesn't, it's not in conversation anymore with all everything else. It's not in the conversation at all. So in mindfulness practice, one of the very important tools we have for not submerging or getting lost in or sinking into something like fear is the mindfulness itself, but in particular, the technique of called mental noting, to really do some way or other where the mindfulness clearly recognizes, and recognizes so clearly that we're afraid, that in the recognition there is no fear. And so that takes skill, it takes practice to being able to sit with fear and to kind of pull back the mind or open up the mind put energy or strength into that cognitive functioning of the mind so that we can write, oh, this is fear. Fear is here. And say it so clearly. It's almost like you're, I don't know if this is a nice or appropriate analogy, but it's like you're stuck in the mud and you say it so clearly that you pull yourself out of the mud. The mud is still there, but you're not in it anymore. Oh, Pharaoh, this is fear. I'm afraid. Wow, the fear is here. But and say it or be it or use that cognitive ability to be mindful so strongly, so clearly, that we're not in the fear. And it can be, then it's easier to just let it be your companion and have a wiser relationship to it. And if there's wisdom in the fear, then it has a chance to operate. And if there's the opposite of wisdom in the fear, then maybe it can just, sometimes it just drains away. So I don't want this talk to be the final, any kind of final conclusions about fear, because there's so many varieties of it. And I don't want you to, you know, compare what I said and my experience with your kind of fear. But I do hope it helps you to be willing to reconsider and take a deeper look and consider your fear in a new way. And perhaps this idea of fear being a companion will open a door for you for a whole different relationship to your fear. And maybe more of you can be fearless. Thank you.